You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 5th of August 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Emma Nelson. On today's show...
If somebody's the nominee, the Republican nominee for president, they need to get a security briefing so that if they were to win, they are not starting from scratch.
What happens when Donald Trump gets a security briefing? We'll discuss the nightmare vision of the Donald and America's intelligence. Also ahead, Turkey accuses Austria of being the capital of radical racism. We'll ask if countries in glass houses shouldn't throw stones. All that, plus we go through the Olympics' top prospects, and not just for their sporting prowess. And what's the worst job you've ever done? That's all to come on Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Emma Nelson. So welcome to Midori House. My guests today, Danny Jacopelli and Tom Edwards. Gentlemen, welcome to your home turf. So how much should a presidential candidate be told about the nation's security? It's emerged that Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump have been told that their intelligence briefing on US security can begin. It's not been confirmed whether or not either candidate has gone over to the White House to receive it, but Donald Trump is a candidate who's got his facts wrong on Russia's annexation of parts of Ukraine, on a video showing the release of American prisoners being returned to Geneva. So let's hear a little bit more about how Trump conducts himself regarding supposedly sensitive information and the questions Barack Obama had to answer yesterday on that topic.
The tape was made, right? You saw that with the airplane coming in, nice plane, and the airplane coming in and the money coming off, I guess, right? That was given to us, has to be, by the Iranians. And you know why the tape was given to us? Because they want to embarrass our country. They want to embarrass our country. And they want to embarrass our president because we have a president who's incompetent. They want to embarrass our president.
As far as Mr. Trump, we are going to go by the law, which is that both the tradition and the law, that if somebody's the nominee, the Republican nominee for president, they need to get security briefing so that if they were to win, they are not starting from scratch in terms of being prepared for this office. What I will say is that they have been told these are classified briefings.
That's very diplomatic, Barack Obama. So, Daniel Jacopelli, should Donald Trump get the briefings on the security status of your own country?
Well, by tradition, he has to. So the candidates get them by tradition. And I think there might be some law involved as well. But it's kind of this precedent that they know what's going on in the world. In case they become president, they're not going in completely blind. But of course, the criticism on both candidates, to be honest. I mean, Trump called for a foreign nation to spy on a former cabinet member of the U.S. But Paul Ryan has also criticized Hillary Clinton for saying, you know, her email's not secure, so she shouldn't get the stuff either. Which is, you know, you could say that's true as well. I mean, I'd personally be a lot more afraid of one of those candidates having the nuke codes. But
what about you? What do you think?
Well, to be honest, I take some reassurance from this. I think we, each week, each day we hear from Donald Trump, we get a sense of a man with a pretty skewed worldview, a man who speaks before he thinks, or in many cases just speaks and speaks again and doesn't think at any stage. So to a degree, it reassures me that people with more salient and germane facts about global affairs get to actually brief him, you know, answer his occasionally seemingly obtuse or bordering on idiotic questions, and put him straight on things. The wider worry is what he does with the information. We know that he's indiscreet. We know that he's easy to antagonize. And we know that he follows this speak or tweet first, ask questions later sort of broad policy guide. And so it worries me that if he's furnished with facts which are important in terms of national security or global security, you know, is it questions about, you know, the Middle East, whether it's about nuclear policy, which maybe we'll touch upon in a minute. What does he do with that information? It doesn't seem inconceivable to me that Donald Trump could make a glib passing reference to a piece of highly sensitive information that he's been briefed be briefed about by, you know, his national security advisors, that he might make a throwaway remark about it.
There is always that risk, one hopes, that he gets it as wrong as he has done about this video about Iran. He was mentioning there this this plane coming back from Geneva full of cash that was filmed assuredly and by the Iranians in Iran, so he believed, and in actual fact it was the exchange or the return of some prisoners who had been imprisoned in Iran and were being brought back to neutral territory, and their return was being heralded as a diplomatic triumph for the United States. Trump has reeled it in a little bit on that one, but Danny, Tom does have a point. We're going to get some of these briefings splurting out in the rallies, aren't we?
Well, let's hope not. I mean, you do wonder actually what is in these briefings, to be honest, and you do wonder if they tailor them to the particular nature of each of the candidates. I mean, I just can't fathom our intelligence services telling him. I mean, do you remember last year, whenever it was, a few months back, Trump says he knows more than the generals about ISIS. I mean, that was a quote. He says, you know, the generals, I know more about. I mean, how could these guys sit there and give Trump information about ISIS? That's one argument. Another argument is it could be good for him. I mean, sitting, not to, you know, treat him like a child, but I mean, sitting him down and saying, this is how the world is right now, it might make him a better candidate.
This is what I think is really important. And I think, I mean, this picks up, especially that point Danny just made there about this broader anti-intellectual theme. And we talked about it in the sort of Brexit campaign in this country. We've heard it constantly, especially from Trump. Enough of experts. Maybe, as Danny says, this will be a good moment for Trump. And actually, he'll be furnished with some salient information. And he may realise that there is a role for experts. And we've maybe had presidents, I wouldn't name names before in the US, who maybe they're not the sharpest tool in the box, maybe they're not career diplomats, and they've always surrounded themselves with smart people. Now, the worry for me, for Trump through this campaign, is he surrounded himself with general kind of yes men, acolytes. He's got rid of half of them even as the campaign's rolled on. So his volatility seems to extend even to his immediate circle. And that is a real concern if you are trusting that should he win in November, which I don't think he will now, hopefully, he would draw from, you know, the incredible pool of people, whether it's security advisors, geopolitical experts that the US still boasts.
I'm just
wondering what would make Trump turn into a good listener?
Well, I don't know. Maybe if he gets a really scary briefing about the responsibilities of having the nuclear codes, or some of the nuances of what's happening in Syria, or, you know, the migrant crisis in Europe, or whatever it might be. Is there somewhere beneath that bouffant some kind of ability to listen to people? Interestingly, the lights flickered then. I hope he's not.
The lights did flicker.
I hope he's not eavesdropping on this and taking exception to me criticising his haircut.
You'll be being quoted directly as that Tim Edwards from Monocle exactly, in the middle of his rallies. That massive supporter of Donald Trump. Sorry, Danny, what were you saying?
No, but we were seeing the other day when, you know, Joe Scarborough, when the former director of the CIA said he doesn't know one single serious foreign policy advisor who has had anything to do with Donald Trump. Any of his buddies, basically, he said, no, none of them are talking to Trump. But, I mean, you were making a passing reference there, I think, to George W. Bush when you were
alluded to it.
But even him, he was a voracious reader, George W. Bush. So he read, like, a book a week. He had a book reading contest with Karl Rove. They were actually, say what you want about his policies, but they were very well-read guys. I mean, before they went into Iraq, George Bush spoke with an author of this kind of famous a book about the history of the French experience in the war in Algeria, Alistair Horn. They had kind of these kind of discussions about policies of what happened back in the 50s. That's a different beast completely, I think, than Donald Trump, who, as you say, is known to not read any books at all and to not care about experts at all.
Well, one worry that I have, Emma, about this is that, and we touched upon this earlier in the week when we were talking about Trump's so-called engagement with this idea of the nuclear, you know, the first strike, whatever it would be called. And that, in fact, rather than scare off people who would countenance voting for Trump would be encouraged by hearing that, because that's their kind of logic as well. And one thing that worries me a little bit is that Trump's anti-intellectualism even now taps into something that we're seeing, you know, the rise of populism more globally, certainly across Western democracies. Even at this stage, people would say, yeah, I haven't read any books either, and I wouldn't listen to what these so-called experts tell me. Does it still sound, you know, that still plays well with that particular demographic? I think that the key mistake Trump's made in the last week or 10 days is that he's really isolating himself within the GOP. You know, I don't think he needed to pick these fights with, you know, John McCain or not endorse Paul Ryan or really pick on, you know, why take on the military?
Well, did you see
it's
what McCain said?
It's such an error for
him. So McCain endorsed, obviously Trump made that comment about McCain's war record, but Trump, McCain endorsed, went on to endorse Trump. But somebody asked McCain the other day, how would you feel with Trump having the nuclear codes? And he actually didn't say he'd be comfortable, but he meandered around it saying, well, whoever the American people choose, they have to kind of deal with it. But it's fascinating how many people who are so-called endorsing him who are terrified of him.
So imagine, Tom, that you are in the Pentagon. The message arrives that Donald Trump's arriving or wants to hold a meeting. What are your options? You either sort of sit down and say, okay, Mr. Trump, this is it. Or do you fudge it? Do you pretend that you've not read the message? Or do you just lie?
It's very difficult. I think certainly at this stage, there's a temptation to tell somebody like Trump what he wants to hear and trust that, you know, the right thing happens on November the 8th. To be honest, if I did have, you know, 5 minutes alone in a room with Donald Trump, I would probably urge him to stand down. I don't know. I still hope that something might click in his brain and he realizes that perhaps he doesn't have the specific set of, you know, of assets of qualities that you need to be the leader of the free world. So I don't know. Yeah, if I was in the Pentagon, I'd probably say to him, Donald, it's not too late, and we could have some kind of emergency RNC, have this white knight candidate that probably everyone's still hoping for, even if it was Mitt Romney.
And of course, Danny, if you've got the likes of Trump up against Vladimir Putin, it's already been noted that Vladimir Putin, a career intelligence officer, KGB spy up to the top of his head, was incredibly good at manipulating Trump by complimenting him by the first thing. That's rule number one when you're a spy trying to undermine your enemy. You say nice things about them.
Yeah.
Trump, by according to the head of the CIA, has already damaged America's international security policy by what he said.
Yeah, well, he also, speaking of Putin, he said he spoke with Putin. I think the quote was both directly and indirectly on a visit he made to Russia once. The Kremlin's come out yesterday saying that absolutely did not happen. Mm-hmm. Putin's never spoken with Trump whatsoever. So it's kind of another one of these. Trump likes strongmen. It's an interesting kind of phenomenon. We've never really had a strongman in America in the past, I don't know, century or so.
Maybe he'll be riding side saddle with Vladimir soon enough, bare-chested into the woods.
Yeah.
Who knows?
That's a pretty scary thought.
There we go.
If it wasn't
image.
Frightening enough already.
I'll leave you with that one. Right. Okay, we'll be doing bare-chested a little later on the programme, but hopefully, courtesy of Fernando Augusto Pacheco, bringing me all the Olympians that I should be watching for all the wrong reasons. Let's move on now on Midori House to the Turkish foreign minister who has called Austria the capital of radical racism after Austria's chancellor suggested ending EU accession talks with Ankara. It's some accusation coming from a nation which has its own thorny relationship with ethnic groups such as the Kurds, not to mention the seemingly indiscriminate removal of more than 60,000 people from their jobs since last month's attempted coup. Tom Edwards, how do we reconcile this idea that a hardline country is calling another country the heart of the radical right? Who do your sympathies lie in this situation?
I think the thing with this is you need to look beyond the immediate rhetoric and look at the issue that this is all around. So the remarks from the Austrian Chancellor Christian Kern were about the ending of EU accession talks. Now, I think what we've seen in the last month or so pretty much makes concrete that, you know, you can call them what you like, talks or a broad movement in that direction. It's not happening. We're probably, well, certainly one or two political generations, maybe literally generations away now from Turkey acceding into the EU. So, you know, the fact that Christian Kern suggests ending that is a slightly sort of empty piece of rhetoric, really, because those talks are dead in the water through the actions of Erdogan and Ankara over the last few weeks. Beyond that, I'm not surprised that the Turkish foreign minister comes out swinging. We've seen Erdogan and his acolytes be very aggressive, both in rhetoric and in literal terms. And so if a country criticises them for some reason, they come out swinging. And that doesn't surprise me. Yeah, I think the irony is lost on Erdogan, someone who's presiding over an extraordinary, almost unprecedented purge of, well, everyone from committed rivals, to media magnates, to local media, to football referees we had this week. A truly extraordinary, some children for reading something they shouldn't have read. It's inconceivable to me that even his foreign minister could really be making these claims with a straight face.
And when you look at however, when you look at the likes of Austria, which, let's be honest, has and is still struggling with its issue of the far right, we have the forthcoming rerun of the presidential elections. Alexander van der Bellen, who won the last elections, I think it was either 13 or 31,000 votes, swung it out of the entire country. A few anomalies have meant that the rerun has to take place. And the Freedom Party's Norbert Hofer is now in the lead. And Austria is this really strangely divided country. The cities are all left-wing, welcoming, open-minded. If you go to someone like Vienna, an entirely cosmopolitan city. If you go to Salzburg, an entirely cosmopolitan city, but drive 5 miles out of there, and the first village you come to, 65-70% of the people who were voting in the last presidential elections would go far right. It is as divided as that. I mean, Danny, how do you deal within Europe with a country that's still publicly wrestling with this problem? And if it goes far right, it starts to set a precedent for other countries.
Well, I don't think it's setting a precedent. It's part of a big pattern with every country in Europe. I mean, look at France, look at, you know, I mean, there's so many countries going to the right. I don't necessarily think this is setting an example. I mean, this whole story, I mean, it's the Turkish foreign minister's job to kind of be the chief PR guy for his country's foreign policy. It's not surprising he would come out and say this about Austria. I'm not really surprised about this at all. But I don't necessarily think Austria is kind of, you know, setting the way for the rest of Europe, but just following the rest of Europe.
I think you're right, though, Emma. Austria has some particular issues which maybe stem from a failure to reconcile what is, after all, fairly recent history, if we go back to mid-20th century, in a way that, for example, Germany's been more open, it's been more explicit about addressing. Now, whether that's, you know, about setting dramas and writing satires and doing comedy about things, or actually having a process of, you know, a sort of a truth and reconciliation process. And Austria's been very poor at doing that. And I think that the problems are particularly acute there. And clearly, look, if Hofer wins, that sends out, to my mind, a purely negative message. You know, you do not want to have somebody, even in a, you know, largely symbolic role, who occupies that place on the political spectrum.
Well, look at Hungary.
It's a deep problem Europe-wide.
But Emma, you're a big Austriaphile. I mean, when you go there, do you feel it's any different in recent years?
It is strange. Yes and no. I mean, I've been going there since I was little. And when I was small, the number of the so-called Gastarbeiter, the Turkish imported workers, was huge. And it was obviously a huge portion of Austria's economy is dependent on the tourism industry. And workers in hotels, cleaners, chefs, you name it, the service industry, a lot of them were Turkish workers who had been brought over following an agreement with the Turkish government with Austria in 1964. And then in 1975, it all changed. The Austrians decided to close the doors, and towards the Turks at least. And that has, as a result, left a certain amount of antagonism between the Turks who are left in Austria, who have to have a minimum of, I don't know, I think it's 10 years or so before they can get permanent residency, trying to get their families, this, that and the other. So there is some to-ing and fro-ing between Turkey. But if you head up north and you go to Germany, completely different kettle of fish. The Turks were brought over wholesale in the 1950s to fix the German economy in terms of their industry. Half, 25%, I think it's 25% of all the people who made Mercedes-Benz cars in the 1950s were Turkish. They were put into a system that works. Austria has this modern problem now that it has a lot of immigrants who've come over, many of them refugees who've flooded over the borders in the last couple of years, trying to find a safe and welcoming country. And the Austrians have said yes, for starters, but they haven't known what to do with them. Mm. And I was in an Austrian village a couple of months ago where they said, we are a village of 2,000-3,000 people, tiny village. We've got 70 Ethiopians staying in the local youth hostel. They're not allowed to work. They're not allowed to do anything at the moment. And as a result, it's this failure, or this failure to address what you do with a worker when they or a refugee when they come across your border. If you put them to work, integrate them, make them feel part of your community, then you will prevent a lot of problems that we're seeing happening now in Austria.
And this is the thing, and it's not purely an economic thing. It's not just about work. It's to do with that broader I mean, assimilation is a word which has lots of, you know, it's often used pejoratively, but that's what Germany was historically good at. And you look at the sort of Turkish diaspora, the number of Turks or, you know, German nationals of Turkish origin in Germany, and they feel much more part of the society in a way that even people who were working successfully for a number of years in Austria never managed to achieve.
You're listening to Midori House. The time here in London is 20 minutes past six. It's 18:20. Back in a minute when we start to talk bodies.
Do you live in the best city in the world? Find out how your metropolis ranks in Monocle's annual rundown of the perfect places to call home in our plump double July-August issue. It's a magazine that tours the globe to find the people and places benchmarking the best in quality of life. And this year, there's a special focus on life, business and fun after sunset. Here's what our quality surveyors have found for you.
In the affairs section, we meet seven mayors from Oakland to Fukuoka, Rio to Warsaw, who are trying to turn their cities around.
In the business section this month, we take a look at the nighttime economy of Montreal, where a group of pioneering entrepreneurs and restaurateurs have transformed a once desolate district into a thriving after-dark hub.
In culture, we pin our hopes on a great night out to Madrid, the city that never sleeps, at least until the next day.
Monocle's double July-August issue is on newsstands now. We'll guarantee your copy by joining us as a Monocle subscriber. Visit monocle.com to find out how.
Welcome back to Midori House. My guests in the studio, Tom Edwards, Danny Giacopelli and Fernando Augusto Pacheco, because 6 hours more or less remain until the starting gun is fired on the Rio Olympics. We've had plenty of pontificating from the sporting world about who to watch out for. What I want to know, not as a great follower of sports, but an enthusiastic spectator, is who I should be watching. Fernando, I gave you the job of giving me a list of all the competitors I should be watching for all the wrong reasons. What's going to make me glued to my seat this next 2 weeks?
I have a few tips for you, Emma, and in both senses, it's going to be good for the eyes, good for e-sport, you know, it's such a beautiful thing in this world. There's the Brazilian diver, Hugo Parisi. I mean, he does have Hollywood looks. I mean, that's part of the equation.
That's a very diplomatic way of describing it.
Exactly, but he's also... could be a chance for Brazil to get a gold medal in diving for the first time. I mean, he's pretty good. He did, I believe he got the gold medal in the Pan American Games. I mean, he does have a hairy chest, but this is just part of the game. It's just part of the game. So he's not like the Tom Daly type, you know, the twinkish type. But it is quite interesting.
There's nothing wrong with a hairy chest, for
instance. Absolutely.
I wonder, as our residential sporting expert, a hairy chest, does that impede entry of the pool, Tom?
Well, this is what I wonder. And it's because it's interesting. People often talk about aerodynamism when it comes to, you know, the follicles in sport. But often it's...
You don't want to be too fluffy.
Often it's a misnomer. So, for example, cyclists shave their legs. I always thought that was for aerodynamism, but it's not. It's so if they fall off, it's easier to tend their wounds and clean them more quickly. So actually, that aerodynamism thing maybe a misnomer. That is Danny, yeah. A little Tour de France.
Did you used to shave your legs when you were doing your little cycling around
London? No, I wasn't that much of a cyclist. Okay. Draw your own conclusions.
May I add that I hate shaved legs, but no problem.
It's important to get all these things on the record.
Completely independent from this conversation.
Absolutely.
I wish we had a webcam in this room because
Fernando's
decked out in Olympics gear right now, and it's a magnificent sight.
Actually, talk us through the outfit.
Yeah, I'm wearing the official Rio 2016 T-shirt.
It's a good one.
It is a good one. I mean, I would change the font. It's a bit too Comic Sans for my taste. I think Oscar Niemeyer would not be so happy with it. But, you know, I'm happy. It's Brazil.
And there's a sunshine quality to it.
There's some curves, you know, I think.
I wonder, though, what it's going to look like on one of those slightly... You have a fabulous figure, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Gorgeous. Absolutely. As lean as a pin. But for those, for the bucket of fizzy drinking... bellies that are going to be sitting in the stands with that Rio paunch. Is that a good look, I wonder?
No, definitely not. To be honest, I'm sucking my belly in a little bit because it is very tight.
And that's just the T-shirt.
I'm so sorry for all those details.
Tom, I mean, when we're looking at the Rio or at any Olympics, of course, we consider the heroes who are the surprises in the whole event that we all think, yeah, we should be looking at such and such and such and such who's looking for gold. But actually, who's caught your eye who you might think... they might not win, but they're interesting.
Well, it's interesting that we've already had today a world record set by an archer, a Korean archer.
From South Korea, yeah.
Exactly. So, you know, there's heroes being forged even before the official opening ceremony has begun. I tend to look, Emma, I must admit, especially on day one, at, well, day one. We know some sports have already been slowly ratcheting up into life. At the opening ceremony, though, what does that tell us about, you know, what the next 2 weeks are going to be like? Remember in London 2012, very doom and gloom in the capital here. And yet the opening ceremony, it seemed to pique people's interest. It sparked their imaginations and it was all onwards and upwards from there.
And before I knew it, I was sitting next to Andrew Muller watching the basketball.
Well, exactly. It draws everyone in. And I wonder, Faye, I don't know, do we know what we're going to get to see later today? And will it serve that same purpose of sparking this whole thing into life?
Yes, and you were talking about, you know, who are the interesting athletes. I mean, for the first time, we're going to have a team full of refugees. So basically, the Olympic Committee, they created. And in fact, they're going to be the first country, you know, parading across the stadium, even before the host country, Brazil. So that should be an interesting story. I was even reading the biography of some of them, including, for example, Popole Misenga. He's from the Democratic Republic of Congo, but actually now he's living in Brazil and he's going to play judo. So quite an interesting story there. I think it'll be quite emotional as well.
Okay. Let's move on to something quite emotional as well. Apart from Ugo Parisi, when's he first up?
Well, I think it's next week, the end of next week, so we still have time to
wait. I won't leave my house until I see him.
Yes.
Sasha Obama, she's a girl who's managed to roll her sleeves up, hasn't she? This summer, she will not be swanning around the White House. She's going to be serving seafood at a restaurant in Martha's Vineyard. Quite a nice place to serve seafood, but it is fish nonetheless. So I thought I'd ask the gentleman around the table today, what is the oddest, worst, strangest summer job you've ever had? Daniel, start us off.
Well, first of all, do you think she's only going to be serving Secret Service officers? Is it just going to be completely filled with security? Or are there going to be actual patrons in that restaurant?
That we'll never know. But I do know that when the Obamas go out for a pizza, they go to the normal pizza restaurant. And it's only at that point does the Secret Service then seal off the roads. So if you're in a restaurant already eating your pizza and Barack Obama walks in with his family, then you continue to eat your pizza unabated. So I suspect, or I hope, they have a slightly more lax attitude. But are we really? You're not going to get the hoi polloi in Martha's Vineyard. Like, that's absolutely honest.
I was going to say, it's not exactly slumming it, is it?
No,
it's the idea
no.
of her sort of like gutting fish on some grim seafront somewhere.
You know, on the docks.
Serving a couple of you know, lobster rolls in Martha's Vineyard. It's not a bad way
I'll take that.
I'll kick us off by saying that my first job was serving jacket potatoes.
Really?
Baked potatoes.
I love a good jacket potato.
You love one, don't you?
I do.
You're a big fan. You've spoken extensively about your love of the baked potato,
Fernando.
I even
take pictures of Dan all the time.
You do. You do. You'd have been amazing around my gaff earlier on. I was extremely good at mixing the tuna mayonnaise. I put an extra onion in it. I always used to put a sprinkle of onions in it for people I didn't like. So, Faye, what have you done as a nasty job?
Well, it wasn't that nasty, but to be honest, I was a hand model for a renowned biannual fashion publication. It is true. But hold on. You might think that's easy, but I remember there was a picture that I had to hold a balloon full of water. And I had to hold my hand for so long. It did hurt my wrists.
Oh, Fernando,
I am not joking.
You suffered, didn't you?
I suffered so much.
Was that in Brazil? Or?
No, that was in the Netherlands, actually.
You were holding balloons of water in the Netherlands and people were taking photographs?
Exactly.
Wow. For your hands alone?
Just hands.
Are you sure?
With hands and feet, but with socks, so it wasn't that.
I want to know what Tom did.
Okay, we're going down a special road now.
I can't match that.
It was a respected fashion publication. Okay?
So someone took photographs. Tom, I will come to you, but I do need to press Fernando on this. You had people take photographs of you and your socks?
Yes.
Why?
Because, you know, it was a feature about socks and about hands and products to use in your hands. But of course, you had to do some fun stuff with it. So they just don't want, like, just your hands. So you had to hold balloons. You had to, you know, use a ruler. And there was a lot of interesting, you know, features.
Which magazine?
It is very...
Was it a famous magazine?
It was a special magazine.
You don't have to name the magazine.
They are our regulars on the stack. It's Fantastic Man.
Ah.
You had your fantastic feet and hands in Fantastic Man.
Oh, yeah. So I'll show you guys later as well.
I can't wait to see that.
Tom, has any bit of your anatomy appeared in an international magazine?
Not that I know about so far. I sold sort of Union Jack emblazoned tat at one of those extraordinary shops that sell trinkets at the Trocadero in London. Anyone who knows that will know some of the privations. We had people coming in there wanting to use it for all kinds of purposes, Emma. I've tried to gloss over that.
What were people buying? What was your top seller?
We used to sell sort of fake Trilby style hats, and they loved those.
That was the
big seller. And those, you know,
so
like
it was really all downhill from there. I mean,
pretty much.
But
yeah.
Still, but you know,
You peaked early.
But you were in the, loosely speaking, you were in the world of style, fashion. Branding, certainly.
It was retail, but far from luxury retail.
Danny, we have 5 seconds. What did you do?
I folded clothes at a well-known retail outlet in a mall on the North Shore of Long Island, New York.
And as a result, you look as neat as a pin. That's all we have time for today's Midori House. My thanks to Tom Hall and Fernanda Augusto Pacheco, and of course, Tom Edwards and Daniel Giacopelli. For now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thank you very much for listening.